broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. The Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Previously recorded with Mark as the host of The Mark Kohler Show.
Enjoy this fresh take on strategies to better live the American dream.
Well, welcome everybody to today's show. My name's Mark Kohler, and man, I'm excited to be here with you. Stuttered there a little bit, forgive me. Just getting in the groove here. I've got my Rockstar Recovery Energy and Hydration Lemonade. Loving it. Filled with B vitamins and taurine and a little bit of caffeine. So non-carbonated, so just know I'm living healthy right here with my Rockstar. I want you guys to know that. So anyway, welcome. If you're a new listener, glad to be here with you. My name is Mark Kohler, your CPA, attorney, small business owner, entrepreneur, author, just trying to hold it all together, scoutmaster, having fun, trying to make my American dream a reality as well. I know how tough it is out there, and I'm grateful many of you can find a few minutes to listen in. I love this time of week to talk business, and this week is the Open Forum Show, and I have got so many questions. We're not going to jump into any tax or legal tips with some of our experts. We're going to jump right into questions, which are inevitably going to provide a number of tips for many of you on a host of different topics so that you can find something that will be of value to you today. I have so many people come up to me around the country that say, Mark, I love your show. I'm listening in, and I find something every week that helps me be a better business owner or saves me money. So thank you. Thanks for listening. Excited to be here. This is one of my funnest weeks of the year, too. I've got the big Halloween party this weekend, the Kohler family. We throw a big Halloween party every year. If you're in the area and you're interested, we'd love to have you. Give me an email. Give me a text. It's a costume party with a trivia game, and this year it's the Grammys and the Tonys. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Wonderful time of year. I was thinking last night about the holidays. We went to a pumpkin patch. I was going to throw this out here, kind of break the ice, a little funny little story to start the show off with. We were at went to this huge pumpkin patch last night. It was kind of fun, and they had a petting zoo, and so all of the kids and us, we went into the petting zoo, and even my older kids, they love to pet animals and just hang out, and it was kind of fun, but it got a little risque. I was going to post this later today. I'll put it out on Facebook. It was pretty hilarious. I don't know what they were feeding all these little goats that were in there, but it was like a big horny fest in there. All these goats started going for it, and these little kids were just in awe, shocked at all these little goats jumping on each other, and parents were freaking out. Some were running out, and others were taking pictures, and it was just quite the scene in the petting zoo last night. So if you can imagine a petting zoo that was a little bit more than, I think it was a little heavy petting going on in there, and it was just so funny, and a lot of fun being out with the family. And I love going to pumpkin patches and the holidays and Thanksgiving around the corner. So want to wish all of you the best during the holidays. Okay, so we're going to jump in to, again, if you're just joining us, this is the Open Forum Show, and I have got just a host of questions here from folks, and I've already got some questions on the chat line, and we've got a live caller, and Ray's thrown out there, how about those Utes? Oh my gosh, Ray, you're the man. I love that you brought that up. The Utes beat USC over the weekend, and a nail biter in the last, 8 seconds or whatever. So fun. And just loving it. So it's so fun to see the Utes 6-1. What a season they're having. So excited about the University of Utah Utes. Big Pac-12. And today, during every Open Forum show, we take live callers as a priority. And so If you have a question, you can call in if you're listening live. We've got a lot of live listeners on here. I can see you already in the studio here. The phones are lighting up, so it's good. Please, if you want to ask a question, please call in. Mute your computer if you're listening on your computer. But if you're on your phone and you've dialed in to listen, press the number 1, and Lisa in the studio will bring you out live. And the number to call in is 866-200-4449. That's 866-200-4449. Whoa, that was wrong number. Okay, let me back up. So if someone jotted that down, I gave you the wrong number in the studio. You heard there's numbers all over. So let's back up. The number to call in, I apologize, is 646, and it's the same number every week, but it's 646-200-4285. I think Lisa in the studio was jumping up and down in there. So 646-200-4285. So give us a call. So we have a live caller already on the line, so we're just going to dive into this, folks. We've got so much to cover, a lot of really good questions. I've got some important announcements for you, too, so I'll kind of spatter those in amongst all of our callers. So first, we've got Will on the line. Will, welcome to the show. Are you there, Will?
Yes, I'm here. Now, thank you. I muted myself.
Okay, that's good. Good man. Being cautious there. That's good. Well, thank you so much. Will, I know you, and thanks for calling in. I sure appreciate it. I guess you had a question kind of about LLCs and partners and stuff. Tell us what's going on.
Yes. So I am considering investing in the non-performing second note, Mark.
Okay.
And the first question I had was, since I'll be working with other partners, I think I've been advised that I should have an LLC to do with. I have other entities. Our active business flipping and buying rentals, but this is something, a tangent business that we're doing. And for the note business, I was told that an LLC would be a good place to start. And so I'm planning to do that. And I just want to get your blessing on that. And the second part of the question is, if I get other set of investors, do I need to set up another LLC if they bring in the money, or can I have them join the first LLC they set up with the set number A of investors?
You bet. Great question. And let me rephrase this so that all of the listeners here might benefit from such a topic, and let me set the stage. So Will here is talking about these second trust deeds or non-performing notes. So, folks, as you can imagine, there's some people out there that are upside down in their homes and they're not able to pay their first or second mortgage. And so there's a market out there where investors can buy these non-performing notes, implement a system to get these people performing, paying interest, and there's these mortgages, or they can go through a foreclosure process and try to acquire the property or even sell the note. So there's a lot of options there, right, Will? I mean, you got all sorts of things you can do with these non-performing notes, correct?
That is correct.
All right. Now, so what I would mention to everybody on this, we're getting a little feedback, Will, so I'm going to mute you here. Thanks, Will. So whenever you're going to partner with others on this type of project, this is great for everybody to hear and understand, is that you could have multiple partners helping throw money into these types of deals in order to acquire the notes. And so, Will, I think an LLC is a great fit for this, and I would like to see all of your partners invest in and be a part of that LLC business that's going to acquire these notes. Now, if you have a separate business that might be an S corporation or even yourself individually, you would take ownership in that LLC through an S corp or individually, and you would take this LLC and bring all your investors into it and get this business off the ground. Now, my only cautionary note on this, and many of you that have had a chance to listen to my shows over the years know that the word investor is a scary term. These people, we may want to classify them as partners. They're going to be involved. Maybe they're going to lend money to the LLC. They could be a lender. Investors is a scary term because a lot of people think of them as silent partners or silent investors, which we love. We love people to give us money and not say anything. But that creates SEC issues. So I would recommend anybody that's thinking of having silent partners put money into a project like Will is contemplating. Make sure that you listen to some of those prior shows or get a consultation with Matt Sorensen, my partner, that talks about SEC, or that Security and Exchange Commission, SEC, rules for having investors. But if you've got no more than four or five partners and you all come together in an LLC, I think that would be a perfect fit, Will, to form an LLC and have all your partners come together in that one entity and start buying notes and going for it and see what happens. So there you
okay,
go.
What if
any follow-ups
you have to
on
bring
that,
in? Yes. So what happens if you found a set B, another set of investors? Do you have to set up another LLC, or do you bring them in into that same LLC?
Oh, well, you would typically bring them you have a couple options. When you have new partners, let's use the word partners. So
partner,
say you get
yes, partners.
Yeah, okay. So let's say you have three or four people in this and you're cranking away and you get a hold of me and you go, hey, Mark Kohler, hey, come be in our partnership with us. This is a cool thing. You have two options. You're right. One is I could put money in and put money into the company. I'm not buying anybody's shares. I'm putting money into the company. And so we'd have a bigger pie, and everybody just takes a smaller percentage. So everybody would whittle off a little of their percentage to bring me into the mix. And most of the partners would probably be okay with that because I'm putting more capital into the business. So they're excited to have a larger business with more capital in it and maybe are willing to share a little bit of ownership with me. So it's not a taxable gain for anyone. No one sold anything. You just brought another partner into the LLC. The second option is if the other partners don't want me in the deal and they're happy with the structure they have there, then you would have to have a separate LLC for that other partnership relationship. So,
okay, so either way is okay.
Yeah, either way is fine. So,
okay.
But Will, these are great questions, as you know, very detailed. So if it starts to come together, as you know, when we set up an LLC for our clients, we'd love to have all your partners on the phone. It's the same price, whether it's an LLC for you or for five or six partners, and the attorney will help bring the whole thing together. And that same fee, you know, we charge $800, so very affordable. And let us know, man. Good luck.
Definitely. Thank you, Mark.
Hey, thank you, Will. Appreciate you listening in. I really do. Okay, so we're going to jump over to some of our questions that have been emailed in, and I'm going with first come, first serve. So we're going to kind of run through these and see how it goes. Now, this is a question from Sanan, a regular listener, and appreciate you for sending this in. He says, so glad it's open forum show again. Have a question on a 1031 exchange. Woo! You know, yesterday I had a consultation with a client on a 1031 exchange. So, folks, if you've never heard of these, this is a great example or question for you to kind of get up to speed on 1031s. So, Sanan says, the original purchase price of the rental was $100,000. Depreciation is $20,000. It makes my cost basis $80,000. Very good. Then the rental property is now worth $120,000. So if I sell it, my capital gain is $40,000. That is right, 120 minus your basis of 80. When I do a 1031 exchange, what is the minimum price of the next property I have to buy in order to defer all of the gains? Do I have to buy a property for $40,000 or $120,000? Well, the answer is $120,000. You have to buy a property of equal or greater value than the property you sold. Thereby, you don't have any capital gain and no depreciation recapture. So you'd have to buy a property for at least $120,000. Or you could buy two properties of $60,000 each. Or three properties of $40,000 each. You just have to buy an equal amount of real estate, and whether it's two or three parcels, equal to the property you sold, and you don't pay any taxes. It just, all of your profit rolls into the new deal. You could sell a single family home and buy a fourplex. You could sell a fourplex and buy a commercial property. You could sell Mississippi swampland and buy a commercial property. It doesn't have to be the same type of real estate or the same number of parcels, as long as it's real estate for real estate. So lots of options there, Sanan. He has a follow-up question. He says, I heard about charitable remainder trusts as an alternative to 1031s. but it seems to be too complicated. Any other alternatives you can suggest? Thank you again for taking my questions. Well, Sinan, that's a big question because I give, you know, sometimes a half hour to an hour workshop on ways to sell property. And I'll give it a shot here and answer a couple points. But let me say this too. If you're a part of our webinar series, my monthly webinar series that's $20 a month, and I have a full hour on the phone, on my computer screen, answering questions and showing my computer screen, and I hyper-focus on a topic every month, and then you have access to all the prior months. I just did a show on selling property options. What are those strategies for selling property? And so if you even just buy into the webinar for a month and go back and listen to that older one, you'll have a full hour of options with my screen share. And I go through installment sales, 1031s, charitable remainder trusts, capital gain, short-term capital gain, all those different options. So I'd really recommend so you're not paying me per hour. You could just go listen to those webinars very affordably for $20. And I appreciate you guys paying a few dollars here and there. I never mean to nickel and dime everyone. There's a lot of time and effort that goes into recording these things and the study and all the work I do. And so I appreciate you letting me charge just a few dollars here and there to help cover the cost, to make a few dollars here on my end. But a charitable remainder trust is really not as complicated as you may think. And folks, this is a theory of setting up a trust, transferring the property to it, and selling the property under the name of the trust. You don't pay any tax. The money goes into the trust, and it pays you out a dividend or a rate of return, typically around 8%. I don't want to say dividend. That's a bad word to use there, maybe. But around 8% interest rate or annuity on the amount in the charitable trust. It's guaranteed for the rest of your life, and you don't pay any tax, and it's pretty darn cool. And so we can talk about that more. But check out that webinar. But the CRT is it's irrevocable. You can't go undo it. So it's very permanent. That's probably the biggest drawback, Sinan. But a 1031 exchange allows you a lot of flexibility down the road. Okay, we've got a question over here from Jeffrey. It says, my question is related to self-directed IRAs. After the whole APS scandal problem, I would like to know how I can protect myself moving forward. Specifically, what do I need to look out for and what questions should I be asking while vetting a new self-directed IRA retirement company from a real estate perspective? Thank you, Mark. Cheers. Jeff in the Chicago area. Jeff, great question. In this whole APS thing, for those that didn't know, APS stands for American Pension Services. They were out of Salt Lake City, Utah. The owner started trading the accounts inside APS and lost a lot of money. To the tune of $20 million, and it's going to have to be shared over the account holders of all these IRAs and 401ks. I personally had my IRA there. I personally had our company 401k there. So please know that it's hurting me as well as it's hurting some of you, and it's tragic. It's just over the top. It's terrible. There is going to probably be a class action lawsuit to go get some of that money back. No one's going to lose all of their IRA. They're just going to, right now the estimate is that everybody's going to take a 10% haircut on the fair market value of their IRA or 401k to help cover that massive loss, and everybody's going to share in the loss. There's a receiver that's proposing things to the court right now. So anyway, for those of you out there that think, oh my gosh, why am I going to put money with an IRA custodian that could rip me off? Oh my gosh, Jeff, this is a great question, because what do I need to look for when I'm interviewing IRA custodians? Well, regrettably, Jeff, you know, there's no guarantee that any custodian or stockbroker, look at what Bernie Madoff did, and how many of these major Wall Street companies took advantage of us in the economic crisis of 2008. If anybody hasn't watched the documentary Inside Job, narrated by Matt Damon, please watch it. It is unbelievable. You can get it on Netflix, called Inside Job. Make a note. It's a fantastic show. So there is no guarantee that any financial institution couldn't fail or cause problems for us, Jeff. But what I would look for as you interview folks is how long they've been around, the number of account holders they have, their reputation, do searches on the web, see if anybody's complaining about missing money or anything like that. Very, very important to see if there's any hint of impropriety going on. There was hints that APS had problems. I didn't know this, but if you did enough research on Google, there was hints of all the problems APS was going through, and I didn't know it either. Not all the problems, but some people that were kind of ticked off and had inklings of problems. But anyway, do really good in-depth Google searches for all of you out there. Now, what we've done in the last 6 months, and okay, now listen up, everybody. This is something that many of you can do where there's no APS involved, and that is set up your own self-directed 401k. They are freaking awesome. So if any of you have a small business, just set up a solo 401k. You are the trustee of that account. You literally open the bank account, and we give you the forms to roll all of your old IRAs and your old 401ks into a 401k sponsored by your company, and you're the trustee. Wow. And that's frankly what I'm moving to. We've got all of our documents approved in the last 2 months. As soon as this APS thing hit, we just went right to it. And if any of you want to set up your own self-directed 401k, be cautious of the scam artists out there that charge several thousand dollars to do it. We charge $1,200. You get an attorney set up consultation through the whole process. I just did one this morning for a client. If any of you want to get your 401k going, call Misty at our office. Tell them Mark Kohler sent me. I need to get my 401k set up. Misty Pasco. Just call our main number, and she can get the process started. And then Jeff, just roll your IRA into a self-directed solo 401k, and no one is going to have access to that bank account but you. Now, you still have prohibited transaction rules, and we'll give you the list of what you can and cannot do, and you still may set up LLCs for real estate deals, but you're in control. Great questions, Jeff. Sorry, everybody. That's a really good question that I think can help a lot of people. Okay, so another question here from Gene. Gene says, unfortunately, I won't be able to join your radio show today, but I will be listening afterwards on the podcast. But I have a couple questions that plague me every year. First, where do I deduct internet-related expenses? URL registration, website hosting, website development and maintenance, internet access. Well, great question. In QuickBooks, there are all sorts of accounts or categories where you could put this stuff. Every accountant may do it in a different, under a different term. We typically put this under web, internet expenses, website expenses. It is true that if you're spending a lot of money on the development of a website, you may have to amortize some of those costs. Now, that's a whole other issue that you could contact me personally about. There's some issues as to the amount of money you spend, but I'll tell you, 90% of our clients, we just expense everything to do with your website. And I would just put it in a couple categories: website expense, programming expense, internet expense, any of these terms that you used. Don't worry about it, Gene. Don't let it plague you. When we, as your accountant, if we're doing your tax return, we're going to combine them or put them in the right title or line that makes sense, and it will not draw attention with the IRS. Next, he said, I have several businesses, some of which need Schedule C reporting, one a Schedule E, a 1065, and another 1120. So you got all this stuff going on. And he said, all except the corporation have internet-related expenses. So can I deduct? So you just create different line items there, Gene, and for each of those businesses, and deduct your internet or website hosting or URLs under those different businesses. I don't care what category you use. Do not stress about it. Second, he says, can I deduct, and if so, where, travel when I represent a local chapter of a national service group at their national convention, where I host parties to advertise an educational nonprofit that has formally designated me as its ambassador, or continue to represent my former employer at professional meetings? Well, frankly, the answer is, and for everybody listening, if you're making money while you're traveling, doing business for anybody, write off that travel. So whether you're representing your former employer and he's compensating you or she's compensating you, or you're an ambassador for a nonprofit but you're being compensated for that, or you're representing a local chapter of a service group and you're being compensated there, again, you typically have to be show that you're doing this for a money-making purpose. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to a nonprofit event, so I'm going to write that off as business. Well, no, if you're going to a United Way convention to help benefit, you know, South Africa and their Ebola medical support teams, well, how is that a business expense? It's not. It's all charity. So, but folks, again, if you have a business purpose to any of your travel, I want you writing that off. So just show me how it relates to you trying to make money. Big deal. Okay, Gerald says, I have a question for the Open Forum radio show. We bought a house in California in 1998, around $255,000. We did a remodel in 2003 for around $300,000. So they're into it. If everybody, you're doing the math, that means they're into it about $550,000. The house is now worth around $650,000 to $700,000. So they have about $100,000 to $150,000 of capital gain in here. Nothing structural, but we did tear down the kitchen down to the studs, all high-end maintenance, appliances, fridge. We've been renting the house out for 3 years, so it doesn't qualify for our sale of home exemption. My question is, how much of the remodel and the changes will affect the basis of the purchase price, and what are the tax ramifications? We are now thinking of selling the house because we live in Wisconsin. I qualify as a real estate professional for tax purposes. This house doesn't cash flow, so it's time to cut the cord to California. Well, I know that feeling. Living here in California, I can't wait to rip the cord too. and I love living here in California, but I'll tell you, there's some drawbacks, and the cost here is crazy. So here's the deal, Gerald, and we just talked about this on that 1031 example earlier. If you bought a house for $255,000, you put $300,000 into it, and that means your basis is $550,000. If you sell it and net $650,000, that means you have a $100,000 gain, and you're going to pay tax on $100,000. It's going to be long-term capital gain. Whether or not you're a real estate professional does not matter. So take capital gain and run. Get out of there. Now, you may want to do a 1031 exchange. If you joined me late, make sure you listen to that first part of the show when I talked about 1031s. And you listed the upgrades to the house. Sounds great. Those would all increase the basis, so you're good to go. Okay. And Gerald, you're so kind. he says, sorry for the rambling. You're fine. Okay, so let's see back in the studio. Bring Lisa out here. Lisa, it looks like we may have some people on the line. Lisa, how's it going there? We got some folks on the line?
It's going good. We have a Bradley on the line.
All right. Well, let me transfer over to him and let's see how he's going. Bradley, welcome to the show. You get priority. Let's talk. What do you got going on?
Hey, Mark. Pleasure meeting you up in Portland. And you came and visited, I think it was last month. It was great sitting into your session and learning a lot.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much. Is it raining today, or do you have that beautiful fall weather, you know, still, maybe?
It went right from beautiful fall weather to rain without passing through that nice kind of high 60s, low 70s. So we're hoping that's still going to be coming back later.
Well, enjoy Oktoberfest. We have a little bit left. So, So a question about cash out refinancing. What's your question about?
Well, basically, when I first learned about cash out refinancing, I was pretty psyched because I figured this was a good way to essentially buy a property, you know, get a long term loan on it, hold it for a number of years, and then, you know, basically cash out all but 20% of the equity. And when I did my, you know, spreadsheet work on it, it looked like it was tax-free. And so this was turning into my new strategy. And then my bubble started to get popped when I was reading some accounting books. So they talked about that the interest that you would pay on a cash-out refinance can't be expensed to the property. So it went from this is the best thing ever to like, oh, can I really afford doing this?
Let me throw out a couple thoughts. I love the strategy still. If any of you have equity in a rental property or even in your own home or something, and you do a cash out second or a cash out refi, it is not the case that the cash out refi is not tax deductible. It's that the interest for the cash that you take out is not deductible to that property because that interest isn't being incurred for the purpose of buying that property or improving it. So if you were to refi the entire note and take some cash out, what I would do is look at the new amortization schedule and say, okay, how much of this interest payment is related to the original principal amount? And so that would still be deductible. But any interest attributable to the cash portion you pulled out would not be deductible under that property. But now hold your horses, because here's what's cool, Bradley, let's say you take that cash out and you go use that money for another business or another rental property. Well, then the interest for that money is certainly deductible on the new project that you use that money for. So if I take out a second on a home that has a ton of equity and I use that cash in my small business, you're darn right I'm going to write off that interest, but in the small business, not in the rental property. But and I'm also going to keep writing off the interest related to that original principal amount that did not change.
Now, the original principal on that, let's say that I bought a place for, you know, $100,000, and the loan was for $80,000.
Okay.
And as time goes by, the place is worth more and more, and I want to actually, let's say the place is worth $400,000 for some reason, because
okay.
I live down in Southern Cal, and it's been
okay.
20 years. And so now, you know, I only owe $60,000 on it or $50,000 or something. I'm really trying
okay.
to get at that $450,000.
Okay.
So if I'm going to refinance, right, what I really want is a $400,000 loan, and I'd like to
okay.
actually to retire off that $400,000 loan. And my first question is, there's only, you know, $80,000 in principal to start with, and now I'm down to maybe $40,000, but I got this huge loan. I take it most of that loan could not be attributed to my original property.
That's right. I just used the math that you said, 60. So it was original loan, it's 80. The loan was down to
yep.
60, and then you sucked out a loan of 400. So I took
right.
60 divided by 400, and that's 15%. So 15% of your new mortgage interest payment would be deductible because that relates to
okay.
the original 60. But that
right.
remaining $340,000 loan that's now cash, the interest on that would not be deductible.
Okay.
So now I'm just going to throw out one other crazy idea, is two others. First, take that $360,000 and maybe go buy a rental property that's producing cash flow. Now the interest
yeah.
is a deduction, and you're still retiring, and you're not going to blow the $360,000. You're going to take the $360,000 and generate, just think if you were able to generate a 10 to 15% ROI, that's going to be $30,000 to $40,000 a year of essentially tax-free cash flow, because again, with new depreciation and the interest deduction on the $360,000, you could end up with $40,000 a year of tax-free cash flow, and
okay.
everything's deductible. Woo! See what I'm saying?
Okay. Yeah.
There's
yeah.
an idea. Just throwing out an idea.
Okay. And also, It also sounds like it works well with the loan to value ratios. Like it sounds like they don't want to give you an 80% loan to value to cash out. They'd much rather give you money to invest in something.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, if you're using the money productively that's going to create cash flow, now you've got write-offs, you've got depreciation, you've got tax-free cash flow, and you now have, instead of one rental with a ton of equity in it, you may have two or three rentals, and there's your retirement, and it's cash flow. So anyway, so.
Great.
Love what you're doing, dude. Keep living the dream up there. And I'm telling you, I'm not rooting for the Ducks when they play the Utes. It's coming up.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. And I have to say, Bradley, I just muted him, but I was born in Eugene, Oregon, and, of course, went to law school in Oregon. And so I am an Oregon Duck fan, except when they're playing the Utes. So that is coming up soon. So, folks. Okay. Now, a question from Mike. Oh, my gosh, this is a big question, Mike. I'm going to see how we do. He says, we just formed our Wyoming LLC in September of 2014. We have not yet decided which tax election to make. Are we going to be an S-Corp? It sounds like he says most likely we'll be an S-Corp. When do we have to do that? Can we wait until the end of 2015? Okay, so first, when you set up a Wyoming, any LLC in the year of 2014, if we want it to be an S corp in 2014, we have essentially until the date you file the LLC tax return that we could go back and turn it into an S corp. However, I may not recommend that you wait until the middle of 2015 when you file the tax return to do it, because if you make an S election and you have ordinary income, what are you required to take, everybody? When you have an S corp, listen, everybody, what are you supposed to take? Starts with an S. Salary. So if you're supposed to take a salary in your S corp and you make an S election retroactively and you never did take the salary, now the IRS is going to go, what the crap are you doing here? And you could initiate an audit. So if you're going to make an S election, Mike, I would recommend you do it by mid-January of 2015 and get your payroll done. Because the only reason you're going to make an S election is if you have ordinary income. And if you have ordinary income, you got to take payroll. So you don't want to wait till the middle of 2015 to do this. You want to knock this out in January. All right, next question. He says, we have not yet set up any corporate designation in California. When do we have to do that? Can it be in 2015 rather than spending an extra $800 in 2014? So it sounds like you're doing business in California with a Wyoming LLC. Mike, you know, I want to know what this LLC is doing. Does it own real estate in California? Is it a small business? How much revenue does it have? Are you going to file a tax return in California in 2014? If you make the S election, Mike, if you make an S election in California, the $800 is waived the first year. So you don't owe $800 in 2014 if you do make an S election. But if you're doing business in California, you better register, because if you're going to have to do a tax return anyway, they're going to catch you. So again, I don't know all the things you're doing, Mike, so we may need to talk, set up a consult. Let's go through it. Last, he says, we have not acquired any business licenses in cities in Southern California region. Is that essentially when only wholesaling properties or flipping houses, when does that need to happen? Folks, this is a great question for everybody, so tune in here. When do we need to get a local business license? Now, when does that make sense? A local business license is really there for people that have a brick-and-mortar customer-visiting place business. So if you – that's the first – and most common business license requirement, that if you have a hair salon, a restaurant, an office, a space where employees or customers are coming in and out, then you should have a business license. Typically, when you rent commercial space or you own a commercial building, you're going to need a business license for what you're doing in that building. In most jurisdictions, you don't need to get a business license to rehab a home you own. Or if you're doing an internet-based business in your basement, I don't need you to get a business license. Now, in some counties and jurisdictions, you have to get a business license for a rental property. In some jurisdictions, you may need to get a business license if you're fixing and flipping properties because you're acting as a contractor. Do you have a contractor's license? So look at your local jurisdiction. If you need some support, we could get on the phone with you and talk you through it. But you would want to go start at your local city. Don't tell them your name when you walk in the door. Just say, tell me your business license requirements and see what they say. Go to the website. But don't show up and tell them your name and address and then start asking questions, because they'll nail you. And you want to be very cautious with that. Mike, I see that you gave me some background on this. It's a little much for a call-in radio show. We may want to talk individually on that. So just throwing that out, but great questions. Okay, we're going to go over to Gary here. This is going by quick. I'm having fun here. I hope you guys are enjoying the show. I want to tell you, I love this. I am so, so grateful for many of you that listen into the show, and I hope I'm adding some value here to these great questions that hopefully impact many, many of you. I'm just in a happy mood today. Maybe it's the rock star. Okay, Gary says, thank you so much for doing the open forum shows. They are extremely helpful and timely resource. Thanks, man. Okay, he says two questions. Number one, self-directed IRA. I have about $25,000 in a previous employer's retirement plan that I have the option to roll into an IRA, self-directed IRA. I plan to take out a permanent life insurance policy on myself and would like to use the money to fund the policy. Ooh. I will ask the insurance company if they would accept an IRA as a policy owner, but from a prohibited transaction perspective, is this something that would be possible? My self-directed IRA owning a policy of my life with my wife as a beneficiary? If not, could I put an ILA in the SDIRA? Okay. All right. Self-directed IRAs and life insurance. Gary, you just got yourself a question punted to next week. I am going to cut and paste this into next week's radio show. I will answer this as part of our tax tip at the beginning of next week's show. You stumped me, man. I'm going to need to have Matt Sorensen comment on that. It's in his book, The Self-Directed IRA Handbook. I know he talks about life insurance in there and what your options are. It's a very, very specific and unique question. So forgive me, Gary, but I guess I'm going to have to force you to listen to next week's show for this. Now, anybody out there that wants to buy a little bit of life insurance and have your IRA pay for it, you may want to tune in next week. So, Gary, I'll hit that early next week. Second question. Please throw me a softball, man. S-Corp for small business. Okay, woo, now we're talking my language. He says, you have mentioned in your wealth transformation workshops about starting one when your net income exceeds 300 grand for the year because self-employment tax savings would offset the cost of setting up and maintaining the S-Corp. That is right. I had planned to set up in January 2015, but may cross that threshold earlier than planned in November of this year. Can you remind us of S-Corp deadlines for 2014? I seem to remember December 1st, but is it any time before December 31st? If I started one in November, would all my 2014 profits received before establishing S-Corp be included, or only those after I establish it? Well, this is the hard part. Folks, for anybody in these last 2 months of the year, in November and December, to answer your question, Gary, it's the last one. You hit the nail on the head. I cannot go back and grab all of your 2014 profits. It's only from the date you start the S-Corp. So I would want to see you have 30 grand of net income between now and the end of the year. So between November and December, are you going to net 30 grand? Then let's set up an S-Corp. If not, let's get it set up January 1st. Now, we want to get started on it in mid-December so that it's effective January 1st. Don't call me January 5th because now we're already in the middle of January again. So call me in December and say, Mark, I need that S-Corp. Get it going. And so there is no deadline in this year. So that was your other question. I mean, I can set up an S-Corp on December 18th or December 20th or December 1st. I don't care. Whenever you need an S-Corp, we can set it up. But typically, I would set it up effective January 1st, unless some of you out there are going to make enough money in the next 2 months. And I do. I have clients walk in all the time that are like, Mark, I got two or three deals closing in the last 2 months of the year. Funnel it through an S-Corp, set it up, let's go. So, Gary, there's your – I think that hits your answer. This is from Chris. In September, I had the privilege of attending your Wealth Transformation Workshop in Portland. Ooh, another Portland caller. It was an amazing workshop that opened my eyes to options and asset protection and tax strategies. I'm hoping for one point of clarification that we discussed at your workshop. Thanks so much. My wife works as a real estate agent, and I am a full-time firefighter, W-2. Together, we have a real estate wholesaling rehabbing business. Woo! Love it. As I understood from the workshop, we would benefit most from having the business in an S-Corp. Yes, assuming you're making 30 grand or more. Yes, Chris, I would agree. Can you explain the tax and asset protection pros and cons, best option to having both of our names versus one of us as the owner of the S-Corp? If I remember correctly, it was preferable to just have her on the S-Corp. Well, this is a great question. Folks, the reason why I want Chris's wife, now he's a W-2 firefighter, the reason why I want his wife to own this S-Corp for their wholesaling rehabbing business is it comes down to three words? Real estate professional. I want to sell his wife as a real estate professional. So as they buy rentals, all of that depreciation is going to flow through and wipe out as much as possible his W-2. They're going to get bigger refunds and live closer to a tax-free world. They're going to have cash flow that's tax-free, and those rental properties are going to be goose laying golden eggs. Woo! Love it. So conversely, a lot of times I want husband and wife to own the S-Corp together so that we can shelter more income under the dividend split and salaries and all that stuff. So typically, Chris, I would have husband and wife own it 50-50, but I don't want you to be an owner. I want you to stay away from that real estate per se because I want all the time being spent on real estate to go under your wife's hat. Like, she is that real estate professional. And she's a real estate agent, too. So that's great. So I would, and I would keep her as the 100% owner. There may even be requirements under the Division of Real Estate of Oregon that you cannot be an owner because she's a real estate agent. And that's the case in many, many states. So there you go. Go Utes. Sorry, Oregon Ducks. Okay, now, Chris Myers. We have a question here. Good morning, Mark. I have a question about real estate commissions and self-employment tax. I have been flipping houses for almost 5 years now. I am also a licensed real estate agent and a licensed general contractor. A handful of the properties we purchase through the MLS, and I receive a commission for buying the property and sometimes sell other investors' properties for a reduced commission. All right, cool. On the commissions that I receive, is there any way I can run this through a corporation so that I not have to pay self-employment tax? Oh, my gosh, of course. Yes. Oh, Chris. I'm hyperventilating here. Yes. And he says, or is my real estate commission income a 1099 that is subject to self-employment tax no matter what? Okay, this is I was going to swear because we might not have this show being monitored by the FTC, but I'm going to just say, hell no, this is not, Chris. All subject to self-employment tax. You can run that income through your S-Corp. You, just like that last question from Chris in Oregon, you really need to have an S-Corp for your flipping, your real estate agent services, your general contractor services. You can run that all through one entity and save on self-employment tax, man. It's the S-Corp salary dividend split. I talk about it in my webinars. It's in my book. And, dude, we can hook you up for $800 plus filing fee and get you set up, and that includes all the attorney consult to explain how consultation on how it would work. Keep in mind, again, just like that question two questions ago, we may want to set it up so it's effective January 1st of 2015. But if you're going to have a couple flips closed before the end of the year, we might want to set up your S-Corp quicker. So, Chris, get in touch if it would be helpful. Okay, I'm going to jump back to the studio here, see what's going on over here, Lisa. I'm going to bring Lisa out here again. Lisa, thanks so much for all you do in the studio there. And do we have any other callers on the line? Are we doing okay?
No, we're doing okay. We're good.
Any questions on the chat line here?
No, Jerem just made a comment. I'm not sure if you saw that or not.
Oh, Jerem's saving me here. Jerem, one of our regular experts who hosted the show last week, he said IRAs cannot invest in insurance contracts or collectibles. The self-directed IRA, therefore, cannot be the owner of the life insurance policy. There you go. So, Jerem, thank you. I thought, Jerem, there was some way that insurance could play a role in IRAs. I remember someone talking about that as an option. So I'm still going to bounce it off Matt, but excuse me, everyone. If it's possible, we'll bring it up in next week's show. Well, Lisa, thank you.
Welcome.
Looks like we have another question here on the chat line. He says, Renman says, I have an S-Corp created in February of this year. I have drawn dollars for household, private expenses, but have no payroll structure in place. What's the best way to handle the October 31st deadline? Woo! Okay. Excuse me for that little cough there. Yes, if you have an S-Corp, folks, this year you've got to do payroll at some point. Now, if you don't have income, don't worry about a payroll. But if you have income, you need to talk about it. So the October 31st deadline is this Friday for payroll reports for third quarter. Call Cynthia or Deborah in my office. They're incredible. They are all over it. Give them a call, 435-865-5866. That's 435-865-5866. And help them. And ask them to help you with your S-Corp payroll. They'll work through that and get you done before the deadline. Now, it may be that you don't have to do payroll in the third quarter based on your income, but maybe by fourth quarter. So you want to get in the system and have them working on your payroll, and that'll be a huge benefit to you. Okay, so now let's see. How much time do we have left? 10, 11 minutes. So I'm going to try to blaze through a few more questions, folks. Oh, my gosh, I love so many of you asking great questions. This is from Kathy. She says, I currently work – now, I'm assuming this is not one of those adronymous names like Chris. So Kathy, I'm going to assume, is a female. I'm just going to go out on a limb. Kathy, I currently work for an accounting office. I signed a non-compete last year. Ooh, time is coming to sign a new one. I really don't want to sign it. I'm looking at going out on my own for payroll services. My question is, do I have to sign it? What if they threaten to dismiss me if I don't? Kathy, you have stumped me again. Not stumped me. I could pontificate on this. In fact, I'm going to give you my gut feeling on this, but I'm going to bring in one of our lawyers for next week's radio show, and this will be our legal tip. I think this will be it. I would like to talk about non-competes and their enforceability. Let me just say this. My current understanding is an employer cannot fire you for not signing a non-compete. Also, I'm not sure if they can ask you every year to sign a new one unless there's a change in your compensation structure. Usually it's only upon hiring that you sign the non-compete. They just can't make you sign a new one every year. Now, that's my gut feeling, and I could be totally wrong. But if I was taking a test right now and I had to check A, B, C, or D, I would tell you the answer would be that there is no way in hell they can fire you for not signing a non-compete. You already signed one once, and that's it. Also, non-competes are very, very, very hard to enforce in professional services or any type of service business because they can't take away your livelihood to go out and do business. Now, it's true that you may not be able to steal their clients, and that would be a hard one. I mean, even if we had employees that stole clients from us, and I don't want to say the word stole, but you know, tried to solicit our clients, there's going to be some issues with our non-compete. But we can't stop them from working. If they want to go out and start a payroll business, go have at it. Go get your own clients and go for it. But soliciting your current employer's client base is typically a non-solicitation, non-compete, non-disclosure type agreement that is quite enforceable. So anyway, check that out. Kathy, I'm going to save that for next week, and we'll hit it at the beginning of next week's show as well. Jennifer says, she's a broker, says, Mark, I am buying a luxury car this month. Well, darn it, Jennifer, congratulations. You deserve it. I love it. Make sure it's got leather. My S Corporation owns a truck that I currently use for work. Look at you. Jeez, truck girl. But it has high miles, so we are going to retire it to sit and only use it as needed. Okay, cool. I drive about 20,000 miles a year, so I'm in the car a lot and want to be comfortable. I've always owned my own vehicles, but I've heard that leasing is a good way to go. I'm going to finance or lease because I can make a better rate of return on our real estate investments. I want to keep my money working. Agree. Do not pay cash for your car. Tax-wise, is it better to be financing or leasing? Oh, great question, Jennifer. Now, in my prior podcasts, I have some shows where I talk about leasing. In fact, lease or purchase a car, I think I did a show a year ago. It's in the history. You would love that show. Go listen to it, Jennifer. But quickly, I'll say this. If you're putting on 20,000 miles a year, I know people out there are already cringing. There is no reason to lease. If you lease, you're going to have problems with excessive mileage on that car, and it's going to be hard to get that lease back to the dealership. You're going to have to end up buying the car from the dealership, or else you'll have a huge penalty. Leasing is great if you're not going to put on the miles. Now, here's what some people do. If you're going to keep the truck, cool. Keep the truck. Use it for all the dumb miles, bigger trips, appointments that you don't need to look fancy in. Continue to use the truck and keep your leased vehicle under the 12, 13, or 15,000 miles limit, and you're fine. But if you're going to bust over that mileage limit, leasing is terrible. Now, if you can keep within the leasing level, go for it. I love leasing if you can stay under the mileage limits. So, Jennifer, that's what it comes down to. Analyze if you can continue to use the truck in combination with a lease, and that may be your best bet. But if you're going to just stick to the car, finance it and blow the miles and not worry about it. Okay, let's jump along here, see what we got. It looks like we've got a caller on the line potentially. I'm just going to go for it here. We're on a tight schedule. So is this Wendy on the line with a question for the show?
Yes, it is.
Well, Wendy, welcome.
Thank you. Okay, so my husband and I are in our early 60s and we own 3 rentals. Our son and daughter-in-law and grandkids are settling in.
Can I just say this right now? I'm just going to interject this right now. If you sound like you're about 22 on the phone, so I cannot. I don't know how, you know, voices are very deceptive, but you do not sound like you're in your 60s. I'm just going to throw that out. Now, I don't know how you look, but I'm going to say you sound young and beautiful. So you just keep talking.
Well, thank you. So my son and daughter-in-law are settling down in Dex Country, Eugene, Oregon.
Okay.
They both have good jobs there. They just bought a house. And we visit them frequently, obviously, because we want to see our grandkids. And it's the last time I was up there a few weeks ago, I was looking around because it's a university town and just wondering about the wisdom of possibly buying a rental property there, possibly a duplex or a small house with a little something, cottage behind it, that we could use as our own when we go up there, but then rent the rest out to pay for the mortgage. And then that would also make our travel expenses there deductible. Does that sound right?
Wendy, you're making me hot and bothered here. I love it. I love it. No, this is a great question. You're stealing my thunder because I love to use that type of example. Buy rentals where the kids and the grandkids are. And, yes, your trips there would be tax deductible. You could work on the rentals. You could stay in the rentals when they're vacant. Fix-up days do not count as personal days. So every day that you're there, try to work on the rentals, meet with property managers, meet with tenants. It is a fantastic write-off. A couple thoughts. I know the area well. I was actually born in Springfield, which is a kind of a little suburb of Eugene.
Right.
I was actually I was actually adopted. My parents went to Woodstock in a Volkswagen bus and then drove across the country. I think I was conceived at a truck stop somewhere in Texas, and then they got up to Eugene. And they gave me up for adoption when they had me in Eugene. So Eugene in the 60s was a wild and crazy town. So I got wonderful parents that adopted me once we got to Eugene. But anyway, here's the point. Springfield is where I was born. Great little suburb town. Eugene is going to be really expensive to find a cash flow rental. But Salem, right down the road, 30, 40 minutes, is a great place where there's a lot of state employees. It's the state capital. You can get great rentals. Don't feel like the rental has to be down the street of your grandchildren. It could be in a neighboring town so that all of your trips to the general area could be a great write-off. So look around. Yeah, Kaiser, Salem, Eugene, Springfield. Look broadly because the closer you get to the university, the harder it is to cash flow and the more capital you have to put down. So,
but aren't
you can
rentals
get,
good near the university? I mean, or does that not matter?
I mean, it's just different types of renters. You're going to see married housing. The closer you get to the university, the closer you're going to typically have more fraternity, younger type renters. And yes, you can charge more, but they're going to be harder on your rentals. In the outskirts, you're going to have your married student housing. And then near Salem, you've got so many state institutions with state employees that are great renters. So don't feel like it has to be right next to the university. Shop around.
Right. Okay.
But
thank you.
Great idea. You're right on it. I love it. So, okay. Well, good luck. Any other follow-up? You all good?
Can I ask one more question?
Well, we have about a minute left, so make it a quickie.
We have a vacation rental home that is barely breaking even, and I'm wondering, although we wouldn't really profit from that, I'm wondering if we should sell that and maybe move in this Oregon direction.
Well, that's a perfect question for just 30-second answer. I am not a big fan of vacation rentals. Yeah, vacation rentals are a luxury. Folks, whether you're buying vacation rentals in Hawaii or luxury areas, if you've got the money to burn, go for it. But I'd probably say sell it, create some cash flow, and get into a better rental.
Okay.
But Wendy, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you.
You bet. Well, thank you. Okay, folks, a couple important announcements. Next week, I'm going to hold my Strategic Wealth Alliance webinar on healthcare. Folks, we are just 3 weeks away from the Obamacare enrollment period. I'm going to have a very, very important webinar next week. It's going to be part of my Strategic Wealth Alliance webinar. It's going to be a full hour. I charge $20. You can get in, watch it, and get out. It'll be recorded. If you miss it, it's okay. You can watch it later in all my old webinars. Look for the announcement. Also, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be in Seattle doing my regular wealth transformation workshop with 70% new content. Identity theft, corporate credit, you're going to love it. So folks up in Seattle, get out there for it if you've seen another one. Thanks, everybody, and I'll see you next week on The Mark Kohler Show. Woo!
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.